computer modeling today, or a good antenna range yesterday, in Mosley's and Telrex's day, measure the real gain of the antenna. That's something that can be done, if you're careful, in a way that's traceable to the Bureau of Standards. Once you know the gain of the antenna, and you know the bedrock equation of the way an antenna works, gain equals 4 pi A effective over lambda squared, 4 pi area effective over lambda squared. At a fixed frequency, the 4 pi and the lambda squared are a constant. Gain is a constant times area. If you can measure the gain of the antenna, you know what area it must have. With a little bit of experimentation, you can easily find out what is the shape of that area. As the Yagi gets longer and longer, the area of effective area becomes almost a perfect circle. For short Yagi, it is an elliptical-shaped area. For a horizontally polarized Yagi, that area is a little bit wider than it is high. And that can all be estimated. So then, once you know the area of effective capture area of the antenna, and you know the shape, you can relatively easily make yourself a paper diagram and start moving these things together, representing stacking distances. You can decide on how much of those areas you're allowed to overlap. Are you going to let those elliptical areas just barely kiss each other or overlap a little bit? And there's advantages and disadvantages. As you make the stacking distance further and further and the areas get further and further apart, you now have no overlap and no loss of gain due to the overlap. But as you move them further apart, the pattern gets more and more complicated. The vertex of the main lobe gets more narrow, the side lobes get stronger. That's interferometry, that's grating lobes, that's physics. As you move them closer and closer together, you lose a little bit of gain due to overlap, but the pattern gets more and more friendly. So for each person, depending on what his criteria is for how much pattern degradation he's willing to suffer, how much gain he's willing to...
Repeater, time out.
How much pattern degradation he's willing to suffer, how much gain degradation he's willing to suffer, and they are opposing to each other, you can decide with that new knowledge where is the compromise that'll keep you happy. And if you're really smart and you get the resources, maybe you make some kind of a pulley mechanism, so depending on the conditions of the day, you can change the stacking distance. That's not out of the question. You can rotate the antennas around their boom and change the polarization. You can change the stacking distance. You can change the azimuth rotation with your rotator, maybe even put an elevation rotator in there. You can have a grand old time, and you can build multiple antennas of this kind and combine them in various ways as a phased array. Electronic steering, mechanical steering or polarization, stacking distance. You can do all of those experiments. And some of them would be a lot of fun to do. So there are ways you can check on all of these things. And when he said that there was a definite advantage for long-range DX of stacking versus long Yagi, which one did he favor? Did he favor stacking over a long Yagi? And is it possible he favored that because it sold more individual antennas, which survived the rotator damage a little bit easier? K2KEY, K2RIW.
Oh, this is KTKEY, if we're going to use them as the gospel, so-called, because they were able to, so-called, be able to do extensive testing on their range with, of course, I don't know how many hands could have duplicated, or that they will duplicate, or, you know, capable in any way of duplicating these exact on-range tests, would you like? You know, these are not the virtual tests that were done on the computer, which was completely unknown at the time when these tests were done. But they both came to that conclusion that if you, for instance, had what would be the ideal situation, for instance, a six-element monobander on 20 meters or 2 3-element monobander stacked. And they said the 2 3-element monobander stacked will display at a, for a DX station, at least a difference of 2 or 3 dB. In other words, if they had the so-called work in that same station with their six-element monobander, and they were comparing signals A, B back and forth, they found that 2 or 3 dB seemed to be consistent with the DX stations with the stacked arrays picked over.
Okay, that could be a real measured result. But there may be another causative agent here, Mel. And that is, when you read what was then a very respected book, the Bill Orr VHF Handbook, published roughly 1968 or so, 65, somewhere around there, the current thinking at that time was that a long Yagi consisted of finding the right length for the directors, making all the directors the same length. Find the right spacing for the directors, make all the spacings the same. With that kind of a philosophy, which is overly simplistic, if I make a six-element long Yagi, where all the directors are the same spacing and same length, I end up with a significant amount of gain compromise of that antenna by modern standards. A three-element Yagi, it's pretty difficult to mistune a three-element Yagi by modern standards. A six-element Yagi, I'll bet you there's 10 times as many ways to mistune it by modern standards. An optimum six-element Yagi, no two of those directors are going to be the same length, no two of those spacings are going to be the same. As these techniques were slowly being optimized, people would say, okay, I'm going to optimize the Yagi by allowing the directors to change in length. So I'm going to find the magic set of directors that give me a higher amount of gain. Another guy says, I'm going to change the spacings between the directors. I'm going to find the magic spacing. I'm going to optimize that. And then people talked about the optimized Yagi, where I let everything go free. Change the element length, change the element spacing, find the combination that gives the maximum amount of gain. So his six-element gain antenna of, let me pick a number, 1970, could, by modern standards, be a couple of dB low in gain, Mel, quite easily. That may be another portion of what he experienced. K2KEY, K2LIW.
Dave, this is K2KEY. Of course, I don't know the time. You and I were kind of young people, and we were happy to, I'm sure, have our little two-tube rig, DW rig, Dick, like mine, put on a wooden chassis, and we read about all these fabulous antenna systems and whatnot in the magazines. I think we just sat there with our mouths open and, sort of said, it's way beyond anything that we could even contemplate in the future. Who could ever foresee that we'd be involved in a lot more far advanced, equipment in our life cycle of working in the industry. But, okay, there was another legend. Aha! Let me remember this one. Here's a good one for you. Because you know what you did? You reminded me when you said azimuth and elevation. They recommended that you tilt the whole array. I don't remember how many degrees. In other words, looking out towards the director, that if the antenna, the Yagi, should be slightly tilted upwards, Dick, that it does improve the low angle of takeoff. What do you think of that, over?
I remember hearing that. It was a popular concept among the guys doing meteor scatter, some of the guys doing 6-meter sporadic E. It was popular for a while to tilt the Yagi above the horizon. And the explanations for the benefit were sometimes the signal arrives at a higher angle. The main lobe is not looking at as much of the Earth, therefore the whole antenna runs a little colder radio-wise. I won't say it didn't give you benefit. I am of the opinion that the amount of benefit was extremely small. Many of those antennas that they were tilting had beamers of numbers like 30, 40, and 50 degrees. When your beam width is that broad, and you tilt the antenna 5 degrees, which is such a small fraction of its beam width, have you really done anything? You've done something. But maybe it's a little bit like pouring a cup of water into the ocean and trying to measure the altitude difference of the ocean. It's there, but it's probably below measurement threshold. So I won't say it was useless. I think the amount of benefit was very small, because 99% of the time, that signal comes out to you from a long range right at that horizon. There are guys on 10 gigs with their 3-foot diameter dish antennas that have experienced a number of anomalous propagations, a kind of super refraction phenomenon. Let me drop. That happens over the Atlantic Ocean and over the Pacific Ocean. When you're using a 2-degree beamwidth antenna, and the signal comes at you because of some really crazy atmospheric condition called super refraction, and the signal comes at you 3 and 4 degrees above the horizon, then yes, on 10 gigs, with an antenna of 35 dB of gain, you will see the phenomenon. And the guys that are operating at a beachfront with the antenna on a tripod, and the experiment with tilting the antenna up a little bit, and they saw an increase in signal. That, I believe, that sounds very real. So a couple of degrees above the horizon, without a doubt. And if you're using a 2-degree antenna, you're going to see it. When you're using a 50-degree beamwidth antenna, I'm getting skeptical. You may think you see it. I sort of doubt it. And when you look at the real geometry of what meteor scatter is like, I mean, to a naive person, a meteor scatter situation sounds like, well, gee, occasionally that meteor, I see it with my eye, I'm looking at it 45 degrees above the horizon, why can't I reflect off of that meteor? Well, that meteor 45 degrees above your horizon is, geographically speaking, in your backyard. The real thickness of the atmosphere on that globe that may be sitting on your desk is approximately the thickness of the paint on that globe. And the meteors are hitting that very thin layer of atmosphere. And you're trying to talk to somebody 1,200 miles away with a whole lot of Earth curvature between him and you. Once you look at the geometry of that, that signal is coming at you very, very close to that horizon. So on HF frequencies, and even lower VHF frequencies, I don't think you're going to see it. On EH frequencies like 10 gigs, yes, they did see it. That's a bunch of opinions. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Okay. Now let's talk about what is being, you know, accomplished presently. What you just said to me about, you know, element length, spacing, things of that sort, are you saying then that the best beam today, okay, let's say with HF, because that's basically what we were discussing for part of this, that an antenna like that ZEPR IR, that antenna that each element is individually adjusted by either a program that will run itself, supposedly optimizes itself for whatever frequency you're on, capable of doing a 180-degree rotation just by changing element length. Would you say that this then is the optimum antenna to purchase if you are looking for a new beam, say for HF, that here's the way to go, Dick, over?
That's a tough one. The Stepper IR, I think, only comes in either 3 or 4 element versions. I think there's a 2 and a 1 element version, but I think the most elaborate version is only got 4 elements. When you let a Yagi really go free, you look for the optimum solution, and you're looking for which antennas can you make significant improvement today compared to the philosophy of 1970. In 1970, a significant number of well-informed people like Ed Tilton, W1, what's his call? It's not FZJ, that's a... what?
DQ.
W1HDQ, yes. The guy who invented World Above 50 Megacycles. People like Ed Tilton were not adverse to other people reporting in his World Above 50 Megacycle column that long Yagis do not work. A significant number of people started off with a 12-element Yagi and expanded it to a 15. Or started off with a 13, expanded it to an 18. And in many cases, the performance went down. It went down because they were using the then prevalent philosophy that you choose the right director and make them all the same length. You choose the right spacing, you make all the spacings the same. They were only wrong in 2 areas. So with that philosophy, without a doubt, long boom Yagis did not work. They gave you a narrow beamwidth, but they gave you strong side lobes, and they didn't have the gain increase that you were paying for. Nowadays, with good computer optimization and other techniques, you can purchase a 102 element Yagi on something like 3 gigahertz that is giving the performance that can be predicted for that boom lantern. And you're getting the benefit. So we've come a long way. So a stepper IR with only 3 or 4 elements, can you really tap into that area? I'm not so sure. You start getting into 6, 10, 13, 19, 22, 33 element Yagis, tuned by modern computer optimized techniques and range at the ferrometry era. I can't even think of the name of the darn article. 1978 February QST. My own article, I can't think of the name of it. I've lost it, Mel. It's game over. Outdoor range improvement technique. Antenna interferometry? Nope. Can't think of the word, but it'll come to me. Anyhow, with modern day antenna tuning techniques, you can find 0.05 dB gain increments and stack them all up and keep making improvements. It's like a blind man walking up a hill, a sight-impaired person walking up a hill. The modern-day instrumentation will tell you which direction to go in order to get the gain increase. So with that philosophy, you can get performance today on long Yagis that was impossible in those days. An ideal stepper IR, if money was no object, I would get one built for me with a
repeater. Time out.
I'd get one built for me with something like 15 elements, where I can change the length of each of those 15 elements, and maybe go one step further and be able to juggle the positions of the 15 elements. So I got stepper motors moving the positions, I got stepper motors moving the length, but would that really find me something? With modern day computer optimization techniques and the confirmations that people have done on antenna ranges, you sort of know where the optimum antenna gain is, and optimum antenna design is today. I don't have to find it experimentally with the stepper, which is a reasonably expensive approach. So, would I do that? I don't think I would. That's a lot of expensive hardware, that when you add that many of them, you're going to have a bit of a reliability problem. And what is the best possible Yagi today? There are places I can go there. I don't have to find it. It's already documented. People like Steve K1 Far Out, Steve Polishin, have done some real good publishing of optimum Yagis by 21st century techniques. K2KEY, K2LAW.
Okay, this is K2KEY. Well, stepper, as we're discussing, is not meant they're not in VHF, UHF antennas, as far as I know right now. This is HF antennas, and going more than 4 elements, you know, on HF, such as on 20 meters, 30, 40 meters, well, even, you know, okay, it's manageable at 10, 15 meters, 12 meters, 18 meters, you know, still within manageable. Start getting into 20 meters beams and all. That, you know, gets a little bit big pieces of hardware up there. But from what they, you know, have claimed and others have sort of confirmed that this optimization for the element length, depending on what frequency you are on, is the way to go for HF at least. That there have been a number of stations on that have stacked them. Oh my God, this one guy I think right now operating, I believe he's got 6 of them stacked, 6 4 element versions of the stepper stacked into a very complicated system of computers that isolate switches and does all kinds of wild things with these beams, Dick. And supposedly he is one of the top or the top so far, as they say, top gun on 20 meters over.
Yeah, I've written a few emails to that guy. He lives in western Illinois, west of Chicago. It is a 180-foot tower made out of Rhone 85. And it's a 3x3 stack of stepper IRs. huge antenna. And you go to the right website and you'll see these huge cranes assembling this antenna. And my email to him was, I recommended that you do this and this so that the wind doesn't give you damage. Because I do see the possibility of a certain failure mode of one of his welds. I used Rhone 65 tower just as the horizontal boom to hold the Rhone 55 towers that became the vertical mass that hold the three steppers on the left side and the three steppers on the right hand side of the tower. Massive antenna. He lives on this windy plain in Illinois, so he's really got to worry about wind balancing that array, or he's going to be grinding up rotators. And I'm worrying about a weld failure can create some significant damage to that antenna. K9, and I can't remember his call letters, but I didn't get any answers to the emails I mailed him. And I'm not completely surprised by that. From his point of view, what little he might or might not know about me, I'm a VHFer. He's an extremely serious HFer. I've never done anything on HF, so why should I make pronouncement about his antenna? And why should he listen to me? Anyway, I don't blame him. So I guess you found that website, and it's exciting to look at all those 150 pictures or whatever of that whole thing going together. Now back to you, Mel, KQRIW.
Yeah, Roger, I'm always fascinated. I've looked at so many different antenna pictures that I think for hours and just gazed at a number of these different configurations and the systems of rotating towers, rotating now posts, you know, back to the Big Bertha system that has been resurrected by K3LR. He's gone in the business of putting up Big Berthas now again. And I just took a gander at one of the typical installations. Oh my God, Vic! You really have to be dedicated to amateur radio just to contemplate such a project, both physically and financially. I don't know how many he's selling. I'm sure it's not what he's basing his income a year on, because I don't think he's got a heck of a lot of takers. But then you never know. You know, there are people who get into amateur radio. They dive into any, whatever interest they have, you know, sort of, as they say, head first, and have to have the most, biggest, and the best initially as soon as they get involved with it. And if they, of course, financially well off, I guess their bottom line is, no problem. But, it's, like I say, it's all subjective. That are you changing this from, what are you trying to do? Make this from a hobby to some kind of a, you know, professional, you know, situation? I mean, you can't call it amateur, really, Dick, over.
Yeah. Where do you leave the realm of a hobby and into the realm of an obsession? And if you're rich enough, you're not crazy, you're just eccentric. And if you can afford it, maybe you're not obsessed. I hope we haven't put Paul to sleep, but maybe we ought to gather him before he does go away. WS2N, Paul, what's NASA doing these days? I listened to the landing of the shuttle, and a whole lot of astronauts came back safely. And we now have as of July, a brand new administrator of NASA. And a deputy administrator is a lady, and a brand new administrator is a man. I keep forgetting his name. WS2N, if you're there, K2LIW.
Okay, Dick, very good. I want to say, Joe, that one guy I was talking about a couple of months ago, an astronaut. I forgot his name, but maybe they chose him. I haven't heard. Yeah, Endeavour came back. I thought that was an excellent mission. 16 days up there. And they put together the outdoor porch for the Kaibo, Japanese module, Kaibo meaning hope. They took three separate shuttle missions to build that laboratory for the Japanese. It's the biggest segments up there. One long segment, probably about 35 feet long, and another one attached to the top of that. The long one being, let's say, in the horizontal position, and another like half section attached to the top of it, and the vertical fashion, and then coming out of the one of the front of the long piece, you've got the porch that they brought up with them, and they made a lot of five different spacewalks, and changed antennas around, changed cameras around, did a lot of get ahead work that they needed to do, getting ready to store extra equipment up there for future shuttle missions that are going to go up. They need redundancy. In case something quits in the future, they won't have big shuttles to bring it up, so they're going to bring it up before the cancellation of the program to leave attached to the station in case they need these extra parts, gyroscopes and things like that, batteries, gigantic tanks. Let me drop it. So with all that work completed, they did separate the from the space station, and now you have a permanent crew up there of six, by the way. So at 7 that came back, there was temporarily there 13 astronauts in space, the most ever at one time. And now you have a crew of six. You have, I think there's only seven missions left, seven space shuttle missions left, and there's some work to be done up there. So I'm looking forward to one particular mission when they put the another node up there. It's a connecting piece. Attached to it will be the cupola, which will be gigantic windows there. You can look out in all directions. Trapezoid type of windows with another window on directly overhead. And these windows will be able to be open and closed. You'll be able to seal, completely close it from the outside. Controlling it from the inside, but these outdoor shades will completely close the windows if they have to. Let me drop it. If they have to eventually change a window out, they would close the outside and then remove the window and put another one in case, something started to fail, a gasket type of thing. But they'll be able to look out and look at all the different vessels that are going to be coming up in the future. You've got the cargo missions from the Soviet Union. It's called the Progress missions. They've been going up there for years. They'll continue. You've got one now being ready. I think it's been 6 months or a year or so that you're going to have a Japanese cargo vessel that will be flying up there. You've already got the ATV, automatic transfer vehicle, which is like three or four times bigger than the Progress ship, going up on a regular basis, starting, I think, last year. Every year they'll send another one up from South America. That's being sent up by the European Space Agency. And of course you'll have your continuous Soyuz craft coming up with different crews. Like I said, you have six people on board, three maintaining the station pretty much, and the other three doing science. So looks good. And then 4 or 5 years down the road, you'll have our Orion spacecraft going back to the space station to bring people, up and down. You'll have that, and you'll have the cargo vehicle also being built. That will be launched on the Ares 5 mission, Ares 5 rocket. Big, big rocket. I mean, this thing is, equivalent to almost like bigger than the shuttle as far as thrust lift power. So they'll be able to bring anything up to the space station. And then Endeavour finished up the mission. They left the space station and let four little satellites out, built by students. And they're being they have a little I guess packet type of satellites being dropped. You've got a couple of them being used that are being transmitted down on 2 meters, and I think the other two are on 70 centimeters. You know, they have 1,200 packet, board packet. I wrote down a frequency for the 2 meter one, 145.825. And somewhere I have the 70 centimeter frequency. But anybody that gets the regular messages from the ARRL on their computer, I'm sure, has read that or can read that on their emails. And then there's a website where you can get further information. These things will be up there maybe 3 to 6 months, up to a year, and then they'll deorbit eventually and burn up. So I wanted to mention that. And also, I think last week or the week before, somebody, I forget who it was, brought up a point about Neil Armstrong using a pen to operate a circuit breaker on the LEM before they left the moon. Let me drop it. This WS2N. The History Channel had a very good documentary on the other day called Moonshot. Not the same Moonshot that was a book. It was also another movie, Moonshot. This was a real regular documentary, but with actors in it. And they went through accurately, you know, they went through the whole mission. And before they left the moon, sure enough, they noticed the circuit breaker switch was broken. You know, the lever was off. Minute off was on, in the on position, off position. Well, this was an important breaker. They needed to know which way it was set, which way it's got to be set before they take off. And they confirmed that with Houston. But they told them, you know, this thing is broken off. What are we going to do here? And Aldrin took out a pen that he borrowed from Mike Collins, orbiting above the moon. He borrowed this pen before he left. And he said to Neil, okay, let me try this. It'll fit right in there. And they decided to do that, and they were able to use that as a lever and move that circuit breaker to the proper position before they left the moon. So it was very well done. And I mean, they even showed before they got out, they were having trouble opening up the door. I remember reading on the past. I know they followed it pretty good. And they said that, you know, we're down to 1/10 of atmosphere, and they couldn't pull the door open. You know, it's amazing that you can't move anything, you know, when you add up the square inches that are on a door to open and close. You just can't do it. And they were down to 1/10 of an atmosphere. And, Neil Armstrong finally decided to give it, you know, like a mighty pull. He just pulled it a little bit to let the air escape into the vacuum. And they were able to open the door. But they even made the comment that, look at this, we're going to go all the way here, and we can't get out to walk on the moon because we can't open the door. But it's amazing how much, you know, what pressure does. Slightest pressure on a large surface, you can't.
Repeater, timeout.
35, Paul. Just in the last 15 seconds, your signal started getting a little bit weaker. Could be a change in propagation. I wonder if there's any change in the power output of your rig. I wonder why they weren't able to get the pressure inside of the lunar module to go lower than 1/10 of an atmosphere. Was it just running out too slowly and they were in a hurry? In other words, they'd already opened up the valves, but it was running out too slowly, or for some reason the valves only let it go down to 1/10 of an atmosphere. That's question number one. And question number two, I think I heard from somewhere that the International Space Station has 3 bathrooms, and I believe one of them went into a failure mode, so with 17 or 13, whatever it is, number of people on board, my guess is it must have been a number of jokes of there being a line in front of the bathroom. WS2N, K2RIW.
Okay, I see the signal is down from the repeater a little bit, so it's probably propagation. I could always switch over to Selden, but I guess I'm okay for now. The three bathrooms at the time. You have two on board the space station, and you had one on board the shuttle and Endeavour. So one had quit. And whether or not they got that working before they left or not, I don't know. So yeah, you got 13 people fighting over a couple of bathrooms. I don't think they mind. They'll cut off the right arm to be up there. Back to you.
Okay, that was one question. What in the world was the other question I asked?
Crusher.
Yeah. Any idea why they couldn't get below 1/10 atmosphere pressure in the lunar module?
Yeah, I don't know if they have a valve that opens up to vacuum or not. I don't know if they might use regular vacuum pumps and suck everything back in into a tank. And I don't know if they would trust having a valve open to atmosphere. You know, one of the Soyuz craft, not Soyuz, but was it called Soyuz back then? One of the Russian craft that came back from an earlier version of the space station before Mir, called the Salyut space station. They came back and they had a valve that opened up to the outside to a vacuum. So this valve got stuck, you know, and when it was coming back, and they found those three dead. The chutes opened and everything. They landed in the Kazakhstan and with a close land. By the time they opened the door, and they were finished. So I don't know if they want to rely on a valve to vent the atmosphere. So my guess, they were probably using vacuum pumps, pumping the atmosphere back to tanks, and to rely on solenoid valves to do that job, or to manually do it. If you're doing it manually, there should be probably no problem, that would have vented. So I don't know the answer, Dick. I just can't imagine that they had a valve open to the vacuum. But maybe back here.
And when Neil Armstrong used extra strength to pull on the handle to crack the door a little bit to let the air out, so the door could be opened all the way, because the sides of that aluminum paneling on the lunar module was so thin in aluminum to be light, you wouldn't have to yank on that very long, very hard in order to create damage. And if you did damage that door so it couldn't be closed correctly later on, that would make coming back home very dicey, because I think they fly without a full spacesuit on, without the helmet, so they have greater visibility. So if they couldn't get the door to close properly, they'd have to fly back with the portable life support system, if it had the resources. I think there was an emergency tube that you could connect between the life support system on the lunar module and the spacesuit. So I guess the contingency plan is they could have flown back with the full helmet, but they would have had much decreased visibility in the process, as I see it. Thank you for any comments on that one, Paul, WS2N, KQRIW.
They have helmets on. Involved in the lunar mission, in the LM, you had two sets of helmets, one for landing and taking off. They were like little small globes that you could see it pretty much all the way around you. You had good peripheral and vision, and you could look up and down, no problem. And then they had the spacesuit, EVA helmets. That was definitely a different one than what they had. And they had the backpacks, and before they left, they opened the door and threw that down the ladder, bounced off the ladder, and lands on the ground. So if you were to go back to every one of those missions, you'll find all sorts of garbage and whatever. Don't forget the later missions, they stayed for 3 days. So whatever they had went out the door before they took off, including the backpacks. I could inspect the helmets. You know, or at least the visors that they had attached to the suits. That all went out the window, or out the door. When they pried that door open, how accurate was this documentary? Probably pretty good. They seemed to follow everything. I mean, they had the 1202 and the 1201 alarms down to the science. He had grabbed the door like with his fingers, separating his fingers and pulling it that way. They didn't show him just grabbing one handle and yanking the handle. So I mean, it was just a little bit, just to release that pressure, let all pressure release, and then they were able to open the door comfortably back here.
Boy, I don't like the sound of that, Paul. When he's grabbing that chunk of sheet metal just around the corner, around the edge, to peel it back just enough so that the air can run out of the lunar module, unless they were very careful to round off all those edges, he is at the threshold of damaging that glove. And that glove is a very difficult compromise to be thin enough so he can feel what he's touching, but to have enough layers to it to hold up the atmosphere on the inside of the suit. You spring a leak in one finger of the glove, and you're in quite a bit of trouble. So he had to be careful in that operation. And when he finally did get the door open, he made it sound like he threw the door down the porch and down the ladder. I'm pretty sure that door had to be used again. At least I think so. Now, maybe they left a certain amount of things that they no longer needed at the end of the lunar excursion. But I'm pretty sure that door stayed with the lunar module. Isn't that true, Paul?
Oh, yeah, the door stayed. That's probably where I started it. Maybe drop out. The door stayed. The backpack and all the junk that they had inside went out the door. The door stayed. That's a big rectangular door, but it's not perfectly rectangular. The corners are all rounded off. Everything in the space world is rounded off. Even today, all the outdoor anything that they handle, everything is rounded, so that they take very good care in that. And even back then, when I went out on the porch, I mean, you could see that they just fit the way they had to get down on their hands and knees and go out backwards. You could see the corners of the opening of the square hatch really are, it's not really a sharp edge. It might be rectangular, but everything's rounded at the corners there. And it was probably a reinforced door, reinforced in certain locations, where it gave it some strength, and he was able to pry it that way. So it's not like he was going to bend the corner of the door either. He probably distributed the amount of force over a large area. Pulling on the handle probably was what they were doing originally, and it wasn't going. So that was probably plan B. Distribute the force equally. It's okay. I'm just surprised he was able to do it, without doing some damage. The thickness of the limb, I've read many times, is three times the thickness of aluminum foil. But it's not aluminum foil. It's still aluminum. You could put your fist through it, I guess, if you want, but I think you really got to try. I think they exaggerate a little bit with that thing.
When they finally got the door open, was there any difficulty squeezing a man with a spacesuit, a fully inflated spacesuit, through the opening of the door? I do remember that on one of the Gemini early missions, where a spacewalk was scheduled, getting the astronaut through the door and back into the capsule was very dicey and almost didn't make it. I wonder if you remember that story. The things that can go wrong. And was there an explanation for what broke off the handle on that circuit breaker? Most of those circuit breakers have a metal bar above them that stops you from having the ability to knock into it by mistake or kick it or whatever. Anyone ever explain how that particular circuit breaker got broken? Back to you, Paul.
9-minute History Channel documentary. Armstrong said, how did this happen? Well, they just both looked at it. So that's what happened there. And as far as getting in and out of the door, yeah, well, they practice with that, of course, before they go up. So one get, you know, if one guy coaches the other guy out, and when he's out, the other guy coaches the other guy out as well. And the mission I'm thinking about was the Russian Leonov, the first guy that did a spacewalk. Not Ed White. Ed White was the first American. He had no problem. He's the guy that went out there flying around with the nitrogen-operated gun to make maneuvers, and he did okay. But Leonov, he went out, and his suit was a little on the big side. It was inflated. He had a lot of trouble getting back. He was in a mad panic. And eventually what they did with him, you know, they were at 5 PSI oxygen. They lowered themselves down to, I think, around 3 PSI. So he had a little bit more give in the suit to get back in. Otherwise, his partner wouldn't be too happy coming back alone. So that was the Russian one. The only problem we had with EVAs was with one of the Gemini missions. Cernan was out there. Cernan, of course, is the last man to walk on the moon. But on his mission, he had a lot of trouble, I think. Was it him? Yeah, it was him. His blood pressure went up. His heart rate went up. And he was sweating. He just couldn't control what he was doing. He couldn't do it. And let me drop it. It wasn't until Waldron went up on the next Gemini mission. He was an expert in all this physics and how things work, you know, as far as maneuverability and orbital mechanics, and he had no problem, and he eventually taught everybody else how to do it. That was one of the questions. So Aldrin felt he always should have walked out on the moon first, but he didn't, and they made the statement that, you know, hey, Neil's never even done an EVA. Here he is, he's going to be the first one to walk on the moon. So there was always some conflict there, but I don't think it was ever really a problem. The commander of the whole mission was the one that was really going to do it. But EVAs, yeah. I don't remember any American astronauts' suits being too inflated where they could get, where they had trouble getting back. The only one was Eugene Cernan when he did it on one of the, that was in a, when they docked with an Agena rocket. Might remember that. They did, I think, two or three of those docking type of missions practicing for that. And he had a lot of trouble coming back in. And I think he lost 10 pounds of weight from sweating too much. So he was in a mad panic. Back to you.
I wonder if the cooling of the suit was working correctly. I'm having trouble believing that all of that was psychological. But they make it sound like it was. Good stuff. I had another question, but that'll do for now. Thank you. Have we heard any words yet about the Hubble Space Telescope repair? Have we started getting any new super sensitive, higher resolution pictures or anything like that? That's your knowledge, Paul. Go ahead.
All I know is everything was checked out, and everything was good. I haven't seen any, I guess what you would call first light pictures, I guess, for that mission. So I know it was supposed to take 2 months, 60 days before real science was going to come back. But we'll have to check the web. Back to you, Dick. WS2M.
Is there still a projected date as to when is end of life possible of Hubble? And I know they put a docking object on the bottom of it so that, in theory, they have the ability to bring up a robot device in order to control the deorbiting. Back to you for any of that. KQLAW.
Yeah, and as long as it keeps working, you know, I mean, that thing deorbits little by little. Every time the shuttle has gone up there now 5 times, they've always put that in a much higher orbit. So if it keeps working years down the road, they'll do the same thing. They'll send up an unmanned craft dock with it now. But now that last mission, like you said, they just put that docking device on there. But real purpose of that is to deorbit it, let it burn up in the Pacific. But if it's going, they're gonna. And the only problem is it's starting to deorbit as the years go on. They'll probably push it into a higher orbit. You don't want to lose that thing. You've got the James Webb Telescope coming out in 2013 or so, or 14, maybe 15. So you're going to have a lag time, and nobody really wants that. If this thing quit working, Dick.
We're still going to cancel space shuttle in the next couple of years, I think it is. There's only a couple more missions left. And what's the approximate mass, pounds, kilograms, or whatever, of the Hubble Space Telescope? I think it is something like 13 feet in diameter and close to 60 feet long, if I remember correctly. Over to you, Paul.
I think it was like the size of a school bus. They say 45 feet, 14 and a half feet in diameter. And what else? Two gigantic solar panels on there, which are actually smaller than the original ones. And the weight, I forgot the weight. I know that mirror weighs a tremendous amount of weight. I think 35,000 some odd pounds comes to mind, but I'm not sure. I think that around the maximum weight the shuttle brings up is something like that. And I think that was the heaviest thing that they brought up ever is the Hubble Space Telescope. One piece type of thing. You've got the Kaibo mission. That was the biggest piece that ever went up. But as far as mass, I think the Hubble one. Back to you, Dick.
Will the space shuttle replacement have the ability to lift as much mass and as much volume as the cargo hold of the space shuttle? Back to you, Paul.
Much more. You'll be able to build another space station or whatever you want to do. The Ares mission, let me put it this way. You've got two rockets. One that's going to launch the men, the Astro. Up to six at a time. That thing's going to look like an Apollo spacecraft, except when it's in orbit, it'll have solar wings sticking out. And then you've got the cargo lift vehicle. It's taller than the shuttle. Two big solid boosters, one on one side, one on the other. And the mass that it could lift is probably equal to. I heard it's equal to the same amount that the Saturn V could lift. So what was that? I forget the numbers, but I think the 35,000 pound limb went all the way to the moon. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, something like 7.5 million pounds of thrust, I think, was Saturn V. 35,000 pounds was the lunar module. Wow. Lunar module, command module, command service module. I'll have to go back and check on what that total weight is. That's a lot of weight. And it's good that it all worked. Thank you, Paul. Mel, have you had any mail this week? And should we be answering any mail? K2KEY, K2RIW.
Okay, this is K2KEY. We were discussing a little earlier Yagi, and I thought maybe that a couple more words on Yagi, being that we basically had gotten off on to the Jaggies that were being sold years ago, mostly for HF. But you did allude to, you know, higher performance VHF and UHF of Jaggies. Would you be willing to proceed with a little bit more conversation on that right now? Over.
As I see it, modern-day Jaggies with computer optimization techniques, computer-aided design, most of them confirmed by real in-the-field measurements on an antenna range, have taught us that the procedure, the philosophy, no, that's the right word, the science, the math, the physics by which a Jaggie works does not run out of steam. For a lot of years, around 1970, people were saying, in all sincerity, long Jaggies do not work. And by the techniques they were using in those days, it was true. They used to think that you start off with some number of elements of a proven design and just add some more elements of the same spacing and the same length. Well, once you realize that the string of directors is acting as a magnifying glass, it is gathering, it is a synthesized dielectric with a certain velocity profile, it is gathering energy from a pretty large diameter of space and trying to focus it all onto the driven element, somewhat like a magnifying glass focusing the sun on a piece of newspaper to burn a hole in it. Somewhat like that. So, they didn't realize that once you chose the spacing and length of the directors, you've chosen a certain focal length of that equivalent magnifying glass. You just add more elements of the same length and spacing out in front, and you end up focusing that radio beam not on the driven element, but you end up focusing it on the third director, so to speak. And that's not the right place. You end up with a lower gain. So when you decide you're going to build a longer Jaggie than the one you've already got, all elements are going to change in length. Everything except the driven element and the reflector. Driven element and reflector are probably going to be close to the same. But all other elements are going to change, because you're now designing the equivalent of a magnifying glass with a longer focal length. And a lot of that was not known. What was really going on inside of the Jaggie? Let me drop. People used to think it was a multi-element filter. By some magic, the forward director gathered some energy, transferred it to the next director, which transferred it to the next director. And why all this handoff should give you extra gain, no one ever explained that. You look at the early books of late 60s, early 70s, where people attempted to explain where the gain from the Jaggie phenomena was coming from. And by modern standards, they were pretty far left of field in explaining it. And slow wave structures, poly rod antennas, the Simone antenna. I mean, another thing that really amazes people is that they used to think that the individual directors shouldn't be fat because they would cast a shadow on the more rearward directors. Well, you can build a Jaggie where instead of each one of the elements being a dipole-like structure, each one of the directors, the parasitic element, you can make them into a loop, into a square, into a triangle, into a disc. Each one of the directors could be a disc of metal, a thin sheet metal disc of the right diameter. That's what a Simone antenna
at 8:30.
That's what a Simone antenna, or a so-called cigar antenna, really is. Optically, it looks like each of those discs are a shadow to the elements that are behind it. Radio-wise, they're not. That radio signal sees that as a non-polarized resonator in space. And it's just a kind of slow wave structure that looks very different. So there was a couple of occasions in which Kent Britton, WA5VJB, who runs the antenna gain competition at the Central States VHF Society and sometimes the North Texas VHF Society meetings and occasionally the microwave update meetings, he runs the antenna gain competition, And he has from time to time seen people take CD discs, compact discs,